This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. So, as the shape of conservatism remains in flux, some conservatives are trying to redraw the line on climate change policy. Jerry Taylor is the president of the libertarian think tank, the Niskanen Center, which is trying to convert climate change skeptics, not deniers who believe it doesn't exist, but those who believe it won't be so bad, into climate advocates. So, Jerry Taylor is working Capitol Hill. But he had to be converted first, because for 23 years, as vice president of the libertarian think tank, the Cato Institute, it was his job to do the opposite, cast doubt on the danger posed by climate change.
I was arguing the line that was probably best represented recently by Bret Stephens in the New York Times, that climate change is real, but there's a tremendous amount of uncertainties, and there's a lot of reason to think that it would be a relative non-event. And that was the talking point that I had honed over my day.
And yet, no more. In an era when your position on climate change helps define your political identity and your value system, what made you change your mind?
Well, the very first thing that happened to shake my confidence in the narratives that I was offering was that in the course of debating this position, I was offering scientific narratives and then I was being challenged on them.
In the early 2000s, doing battle on TV, you were on a show with climate activist Joe Rahm, and you quoted the testimony of climate scientist James Hansen back in 1988.
Right. So this is the first leg in the stool of my position that got wobbly. I had argued that in 1988, James Hansen had testified in front of the United States Senate, and he said if we continued with business as usual, we'd see warming of X within the next decade.
X degrees.
Right. And more than a decade has passed, and if you look at the warming we've seen, it's only been about a quarter of that. So I'd argued that Hansen clearly overestimated the degree to which the climate is sensitive to greenhouse gas emissions, and this is bracing evidence that climate change won't be as serious as we think. And so when I got done with the show, Joe Rahm asked me in the green room if I had read that testimony recently, and I confess it's been a while. I was simply reflecting on testimony that some of my colleagues had offered in the Senate themselves some months back. So you're on TV with me, says Joe, and you make a claim, and I've got 20 seconds to answer it. And he says, if you want to keep being a hack, feel free. And he challenged me to go back and read the testimony that Hansen had provided in the Senate. And he said, look, if you do, what you're going to find is that the reason Hansen was off with his projection isn't that he overestimated climate sensitivity. Hansen had overpredicted how much greenhouse gases we put up there in the following decade.
Do you know why he overpredicted that?
Well, that's very uncertain. I mean, how can you foresee recession? How can you foresee trade developments, technological innovation? He had a couple of other scenarios as well. If you look at those scenarios with the emissions trajectories that we've actually seen, and he also had a temperature projection for that emission scenario, and it was pretty much exactly correct. Then I went to the climate scientists who were offering this story about how James Hansen was off and asked them what I'm missing here, because we shouldn't be going around arguing that James Hansen is a crackpot. And it turned out that the scientists I had talked to seemed to be fully aware of the problems with their narrative, but they didn't care. Look, I'm not a scientist, but I trusted these scientists to well inform me on the matters, and I can no longer really trust them. From that point forward, I began to do far more due diligence on the scientific narratives that I was deferring to from the scientists who were in our camp. And I found out that the more you did that due diligence, the more you found variations of that story playing out again and again and again and again. And so I put the scientific arguments aside and I migrated more towards economic arguments about climate action.
Has your message evolved over time as you've gotten the responses back?
Well, it has. I think you can make a very strong argument for a policy response to climate change without getting involved in a hot debate about the science. And the reality is whether Republicans like it or not, there is going to be a unilateral U.S. policy response to climate change that they can't do anything about. 30% of the U.S. economy has a carbon price through state policy. More than 24 states have mandates on the electricity sector to produce percentages of renewable energy. So the reality is that there will be a response. Would you rather it be market-friendly and harnessing capitalism or hostile to the market by harnessing regulators? This seems like an easy call. Well, it turns out that this is akin to telling Southerners that whether they like it or not, their best course of action is to have Lee go to Appomattox and sign a surrender paper to Ulysses S. Grant. And so that's an evolution in our strategy. We began by sidestepping any hot discussion about science on Capitol Hill, but it became clear that we could not do that. Turns out that it's very difficult to motivate Republicans to act against climate if they're not convinced that climate change is a significant risk.
So you first have to convince them that their skepticism is on shaky ground, and then you bring in the economic argument, and you've said that one of the most influential people you spoke to with regard to this is a guy named Bob Litterman, who was the head of risk management at Goldman Sachs.
Yeah, Bob came to my office one day and said, look, you have a hot dispute about the most likely outcomes from climate change. You say it'll be modest and economically manageable. Others say it'll be at the high end of the projections and be a catastrophe. And you argue that you're right, therefore climate action shouldn't occur, and they argue they're right, and therefore we need to engage in a very dramatic response. But that's the wrong conversation to have. We have a wide range of possible outcomes from climate change. There's a lot of uncertainty, that is true, but the uncertainty cuts both ways. It may be modest, it may be catastrophic. In risk management, you said the work that I did at Goldman, we dealt with issues like this all the time. We didn't worry so much about the most likely outcome. We hedge against risk.
His point was that if this kind of risk were to arise in any other context in the private markets, people would pay real money to hedge against it.
Yeah, I mean, there's nothing we can invest in that will make us whole if climate change occurs. No such thing exists. So in financial markets, we call these non-diversifiable risks. And we know that when people in financial markets deal with non-diversifiable risks, they pay huge amounts of money to avoid them. And if we look at climate change as an example of a non-diversifiable risk that we have to jointly entertain, behave in the same fashion when it comes to climate action, and it's an open and shut case for policy response.
How are you getting your message out?
Mostly in face-to-face meetings. Our objective is to talk directly to the Republicans who are engaged in policymaking. So we spend a tremendous amount of our time on Capitol Hill, meeting with elected members of the House and the Senate, meeting with senior staff, meeting with senior committee staff. And we do talk to Democrats as well. We're not just the Republican whisperers. Because the reality is we're not going to see a unified Republican Party embrace climate action. We're going to need a bipartisan coalition. And when you talk to Republicans on Capitol Hill, you find that there are maybe 40 or so, perhaps 50 in the House, and maybe 10 or 12 Republicans in the Senate who are deeply uncomfortable being interned in the denialist penitentiary of the Republican Party. They would like to break out. They would like to have a Republican response to climate change that is meaningful. But they're not entirely sure what that response ought to look like, and they're not sure there's a window of opportunity for them politically to forward that idea.
So what is that response?
Well, we believe the best response is to simply put a price on greenhouse gas emissions that is robust and allows us to begin the process of decarbonizing the economy, and then leave it to people in the marketplace to decide when, where, and how to achieve those emissions reductions. Far better to simply turn the market loose to respond to climate change with accurate price signals and to turn regulators loose and then have an endless technocratic dispute, which is not so easily resolved, about whether wind is better than solar or better than nuclear power, and how much of a role should energy efficiency play, and what kind of rules and guidelines should we have, and then regulate every nook and cranny of the economy so that we have the most energy efficient light bulbs possible or what have you. Far better to just unleash the pricing mechanisms to give people incentives to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. We'll let them discover through profit or loss the best ways to do that. Now, that's the consensus position of virtually all the economists who study in this issue. Heck, it's the position of ExxonMobil. It's the position of Al Gore. It's the position of James Hansen. So we think that's the right approach, and it's one that seems relatively attractive to Republicans. After all, they need to brand a policy response in a fashion that looks Republican. If you ask Republicans to simply endorse policy ideas that have been endorsed by Al Gore and that it concede that Gore was right on climate change and he was right about policy response, you're never going to win that fight. You need something that looks distinctly Republican.
You suggest that maybe there are 40 or 50 Republicans in the House, maybe 10 or 12 in the Senate, who feel trapped in the denialist prison and would love a way out. Is this giving them a way out?
We found that privately a lot of Republicans are very interested in carbon pricing. They need to see a political way to get there, however. You need a window of opportunity to appear. We have some windows that will be opening soon on tax reform, for instance. Republicans are not going to pass a $4 trillion tax cut without any offsets. And a carbon tax could provide $2 trillion in 10 years. That's a pretty big lift. And while that's unpopular in the Republican Party, so is every other revenue offset. Value-added tax is not popular. A giant loophole closing operation is not popular. A border adjustment tax is not popular. So where are the Republicans going to go? So there's an opportunity there. There's an opportunity when it comes to the infrastructure package. Once again, we're looking at spending Lord knows how much. We have got no plan here, but we're talking something around $1 trillion over 10 years. And that would be nice to pay for, and a carbon tax might be a good way of paying for that as well. Donald Trump has entertained an increase in the federal gasoline tax as a means of paying for it. So that's a possibility. And another possibility is if Republicans are looking at 2018 as a exercise in grim death with the indivisible movement and Democrats threatening to take over the House, they then have to think about the fact that all of the levers and buttons in the EPA cockpit that gave them the Clean Power Plan and the prospect of far more will still be there for a Democratic president after maybe 2020. And if it's time for them to cut a deal on climate change, now is a really good time to cut one because they won't have as much political strength now as they in the future. So that's another possibility for us.
So tell me about what sets you apart from your liberal counterparts arguing to get policymakers to take climate change seriously. What are the liberals getting wrong here?
The first thing is in American politics, oftentimes the messenger is more important than the message. And conservatives are simply unlikely to listen seriously to environmentalists simply because of who they are. And that's human nature. So there's a messenger problem, which we hope to solve in this canon because we come from the conservative Republican Team Red community.
But you're funded by the liberal Rockefellers, right?
We're funded by a lot of different people, but for the most part, nobody on the Hill really cares one way or the other. Our ideological DNA is fairly obvious to everybody. The second thing I think that liberals often get wrong is that they overstate certainty. And there is a lot of uncertainty here. So if you are going to get in the grill of a Republican who's agnostic or skeptical about climate change and talk about how Westworld is an inevitability 100 years hence, you're going to get a lot of pushback. And so talking about this as a risk just like any other, that resonates. But what doesn't resonate is overstating how much we can be certain about different outcomes. So that's also been a problem.
People will remember 40 years ago when the population explosion was the big issue.
Yeah, it's a standard trope from the right. And in fact, that's one of the things that I used to offer as well to Cato donors in my speeches. And it's like, well, environmentalists told us that the population bomb was going to devastate mankind, and that bomb never went off. And then we were told in the 70s that we were about to run out of oil, gas, coal, tin, aluminum, nickel, copper, everything, and we would have a resource-starved society, and that never came to pass either. And so it's easy to point to left-of-center or environmentalist arguments about doom on the horizon when that horizon never came.
Mm-hmm.
So when it became clear that population growth was not going to turn us into Saulian green eaters where we were going to move into some Malthusian hell, we moved on, and the medical and economic and scientific community moved on to other matters. The same thing with resource depletion. But climate change has been with us now as a live concern for more than 30 years, and it gained strength with every single passing year. The science behind it gained strength. The economic case for acting gained strength. It's not a here again, gone tomorrow cry of wolf. It's been put to the scientific test, and it continues to pass that test, and actually the case for it continues to get stronger.
Opposing climate change policy seems to have become part of the conservative identity. How do you untangle the two?
Well, the conservative identity can change fast. Who would have expected 2 years ago that the Republicans would nominate for president someone who is against free trade, which has been a Republican position for about four decades, someone who was as ferociously hostile to immigration as he was, whereas the Republican Party used to be the party of the shining city on the hill. It's also easy to forget that less than a decade ago, this very same Republican Party nominated for president John McCain, who argued for climate action, which was even more aggressive than what Barack Obama attempted to do in the White House. And the Republicans adopted a platform in 2008 that, when discussing climate change, called for deep decarbonization using market forces. Now, the point here is not to make predictions about the future, but is to say party orthodoxies can change faster than you think.
Thank you very much, Jerry.
Thank you for having me.
Jerry Taylor is the president of the libertarian think tank, the Niskanen Center.
The weather is frightening. The thunder and lightning seem to be having their way. But as far as I'm concerned, it's a lovely day. The turn in the weather will keep us together, so I can honestly say that as far as I'm concerned, it's a lovely day. And everything's okay.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Mira Sharma, Alana Casanova-Burgess, Jesse Brenneman, and Michael Loewinger. We had more help from Sara Kari, Leia Feder, and Kate Bakhtiarova. And our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineers this week were Sam Baer and Terrence Bernardo.
Katya Rogers is our executive producer. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
On the Media is supported by the Ford Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.